Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. As strong supporters of the American Kennel Club, we talk about everything from conformation to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between. Your passion is our purpose. Tremendous thanks to our sponsor, Royal Canin. Every day, more top breeders are choosing Royal Canin. Join the winning team. Okay, crew, before we get into today's show, I am super excited to tell you about something new here at Pure Dog Talk. We know breeders are the lifeblood of our sport. We celebrate and honor our master breeders. So we're bringing you Breeders' Voice. Breeders' Voice sits down with top breeders, sharing their secrets, how they got where they are, the joys, and maybe even the heartbreaks. If you haven't had a chance, click the Don't Miss an Episode button so you'll get these in-depth articles delivered free along with your podcast. Sign up on our Facebook page or at puredogtalk.com. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves, and I have for you today a very interesting, to me, very exciting interview with Dr. Karen Overall. She's a senior research scientist at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's going to talk to us about the genetics of temperament, the genetics of aggression and anxiety, and some of these things that we run into with our purebred dogs that turns out have some genetic component. So, Karen, thank you. Welcome to the show. I appreciate your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
I am thrilled. This is like, I've been waiting for this for a month, so.
I think that the data may not live up to that expectation.
It's just a particularly favorite topic of mine. So can you give us kind of the 411, right? Like, what brought you to this behavioral medicine study?
Yeah, what brought me to the field of veterinary behavioral medicine was actually an accident. I was getting dual veterinary and PhD degrees, and I thought that I would just do pure research. And then it's a problem that everybody who has an academic spouse is aware of. I went to one place to do my PhD. He was able to travel. I came back. I ended up back at the place where I'd gone to vet school, and there was a residency available. And I thought, it's in behavior. I wonder if that could help with any aspect of my future research. At that point, I was interested in behavioral genetics of another kind. But, you know, I was looking out long term, and I was thinking, and it would be nice to have some money while I'm back here. So I did this residency in behavioral medicine, and I remember for the first couple of months thinking every single day that I was going to slit my wrists when I got home, because it wasn't clicking for me. I loved teaching the students. I loved interacting with the clients. I'd always enjoyed interacting with clients. I'd moonlit to make extra money in graduate school. So I love working with clients because what I'm doing when I deal with a client is I'm teaching. You know, I'm explaining the disease process. I'm explaining the preventive process. I'm explaining what the dog or the cat or the bird or the rabbit is saying. I'm showing them how to interact. I'm pointing out things that I find interesting. I like that people are interested in that, and I love that they fall in love with and they have this wonderful relationship with non-human animals. I think it makes them nicer towards human animals. I think it gives them compassion. I think it's a defining relationship in a child's life. It can turn that child into a humane, compassionate adult. And frankly, I don't trust people who don't like animals in any regard. If you either don't like them, or you are afraid of them, or you don't find them interesting, I begin to wonder. So for me, you know, those things are just natural. But I liked the clients, I liked the teaching, but intellectually, I was not the least bit stimulated, and it was driving me nuts. And I was thinking, I just can't wait till I get back to pure research, you know, get my research finished, get my thesis done, get all of this, and back to pure research. And then one day, the patient that walked in the door couldn't stop spinning, and he was spinning his way through the waiting room. And then he spun his way down the hallway on the way to the behavioral exam room. And then for much of the next 2.5 hours, he spun most of the time, intermittently stopping when he was truly exhausted. And it was that dog, and I still remember that dog, and it was that dog that said to me, whoa, this is interesting. This is truly abnormal. this looks like human obsessive compulsive disorder. And if it is, there's a good chance it has a genetic basis or it's the result of a genetic defect. And this could be interesting.
Wow.
And that's how it started. So after that, I began to let people know the things I was interested in. And we still got the straightforward, my cat isn't using its litter box. Well, when was the last time you actually cleaned the litter box? You know, and if you do it twice a year, I guess we're really not surprised that the cat doesn't like a filthy toilet. But we got fewer and fewer and fewer of those cases as the vets in the area became better educated, and more and more and more of truly fascinating cases. And although I don't see cases every day of the week, now I can honestly say that every single case I see is of some amount of research interest to me.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
You can raise your patients. People don't realize this. You raise your patients, you raise your clients. You know, you can get people to be interested and think about these things, and the better educated they are and the better the tools you provide veterinarians as a tertiary care center or as a specialist, the better quality of patients and clients you're going to get, and you're going to get to see those interesting things that are intellectual challenges to you. Where, if you're a young person, you can make your reputation, if that matters to you. I wasn't thinking that way then. That sort of happened accidentally for me, and I was a little stunned. But people now do think about that a lot. But it's also a place where there's just interesting stuff. People are at their wits' end. They're bringing you these animals. They wouldn't bring them to you if they didn't love them. They're committed to them. You can learn a heck of a lot, and you can make a big difference in somebody's life.
Right. Well, and I think it is just awesome that this is available, right? And I think of the education that we do here at Pure Dog Talk on the podcast that, I mean, you just espoused my entire theory. Education is the solution to everything. And so that's why we're talking to you.
Well, you know, the funny thing about education is it may not work, it may not take, but that doesn't give you the option to not do it, because without it, you're guaranteed that what you have is ignorance.
Exactly. Perfect. So can you start with just kind of a basic discussion of some of the identified genetic behavioral issues? So you talked about aggression and you talked about anxiety in some of the stuff that I've read.
And there are a number of clear-cut behavioral concerns that look to have genetic predispositions. And let me just say what that means. When you look at a pedigree and 50% of the dogs in that family line have a variant of a certain condition, the chances that there's a genetic contribution to that, especially if that condition has been identified in other species, generally humans, or in an induced rodent, of the rodents are bred for laboratory studies. If that model exists in either an induced model with a knockout gene or a bred model in rodents or in humans, chances are that pedigree you're looking at is representative of an increased risk for this condition that's genetic. Now, the nightmare situation that everybody has discovered is that we can all sort these dogs. I can teach anybody to sort dogs into two groups, affected or not affected. Tell me what the condition is. It could be obsessive compulsive disorder. You know, you can have people bring in their seven pointers that they have, their German short-haired pointers. And the two that are chasing lights are very obvious, and the five that are not are very obvious.
Right.
You know, the dogs who react to noises, these profound noise reactivities or phobias. And we sort of lump them all together because many dogs with relatively minor fears to noise then go on to be phobic, and we don't know which ones will. So from the standpoint of genetically screening them, we take the dogs who are distressed, and then the dogs who are truly fearful, and then the dogs who are truly phobic. And we lump them all together simply because we generally never have enough dogs in one family line to separate them out in any kind of numbers. And whether it's progressive or whether those are three truly different states, they should at least have shared underlying genes. They may not all have the same genes. But when we do that, in one of our studies, we found out that we had seven risk genes that approach significance. Now, that was with hundreds and hundreds of dogs of three different herding breeds. And that still wasn't enough to sort it out because the vast majority of these conditions appear to be both polygenic and shaped by the environment. And part of the problem is with something like fears of noises, if you're never in that environment, if you live in the wilds of Oregon, you're never going to hear a thunderstorm.
Right.
Okay, and if you don't live by fireworks and the people by you don't fire off guns, chances are you're not going to hear these things. Contrast that with living in Philadelphia, where the other night we had a thunderstorm that woke us all up at 4 o'clock in the morning. We had three dogs in bed. You know, it's a little hard to separate out from the gunshots and the backfires. And right. Then, you know, the Eagles won last week, so
had
fireworks.
Yes. That would have been crazy.
Yeah, so it's just been one long set of stimuli for the noise-phobic dogs in the Philadelphia area all week. So, you know, you've got to remember that we don't see some of these things. So we only see these conditions that are expressed. But we know that all of the obsessive-compulsive disorders, it doesn't matter whether it's the type of flank-sucking that Nick Dodman studied, or the spinning in circles, or the seeing things that don't exist, or the selecting certain substrates to put in your mouth and mouth and do those types of things, and some of the much more minor ones, they all seem to run in family lines. And if you can get hold of purebred dogs who do them, and you get a chance to ask everybody, and you know the way we usually do it is I'll ask for a pedigree, and then I'll say, how many of these people can we talk to either electronically or in person? And we just want to know, here's a questionnaire, here's a standardized screening questionnaire that has been shown to be highly reliable. We just want to know if these dogs do any of these things. And we never ask, do you think your dog is anxious? Do you think your dog is fearful? Do you think your dog is aggressive? We ask about very specific behaviors that we know have helped us in discriminant analyses in the past and have identified differences in patterns of genes that seem to be inherited together, whether or not they're good for markers. The problem is, when we started out, all of us sort of believed that dog breeds, they're perfect. They live with us. They're exposed to our environments. They're canalized pools of genetic variation. So, you know, you've got Bernese mountain dogs, and you've got other sort of mountainous type Swiss dogs. So they've got overlapping pools. You know, a Sennenhund has an overlapping but not identical gene pool. God, if we can find a condition they both share, we can start to pick out the genes. And that has been difficult because, as I said, there are three things operating. The phenotype is not always expressed, and it's certainly not expressed equally, and we don't have good ways of measuring it. What we have found in our studies of noise and fear is that people, when they tell you something exists, if they say, this dog will withdraw if you reach for it, or this dog, if there's a loud noise, is going to pant and pace, and that dog's going to spin in circles, they'll be right. But they have false negatives. In other words, they think that the dog is not distressed because they didn't see it sitting there shaking and panting. So they think it's okay, until you put it in a provocative test. So until you play a standardized noise CD at a range of decibel levels, and we've had people say, oh my God, I've never seen the dog do that. Well, trust me, if that dog was experiencing a similar circumstance, that dog did that. Or they'll say, you know, well, I never thought the dog was outgoing, but I didn't know it was afraid. Well, it's not their job to diagnose their dog. So in addition to the fact that we don't always see the phenotype expressed because the triggers aren't there, the people who are helping us identify it may incompletely recognize it. So we get false negatives, which is why some kind of humane provocative test is needed. And I say this because for our noise phobia studies, we had a standardized CD and we played it at a certain volume. And I had a level at which that 3.5 minute CD was stopped. They didn't have to make it to the end. And if the dog was still distressed, everybody agreed beforehand that we would give the dog medication. So if the dog instantly didn't stop being distressed, we weren't going to let this dog suffer.
Right.
You know, so that raises a question, though, for how we're going to assess many aggressive dogs, because we know these aggressions also run in family lines. And then the third problem that we have is, of course, that we have multiple genes involved. Some of them are time penetrant. Some of them may be only expressed in certain environmental conditions. And this has been a big problem for working dogs. And when people like Eric Wilson of the Swedish Military Dogs, who has 30 years of data on their purpose-bred dogs, went back and looked. He said, you know, whatever we're calling temperament, this dog who's a good working dog, even if we allow for slight changes in our program of what we wanted and how we shifted the breeding, at no time did the amount of heritability that was genetic, in other words, at no time did the genetic component ever exceed 30%.
Huh.
The rest of it was how that dog came up, what he was exposed to, how he reacted to his environment, sometimes which household he ended up in, which trainer he ended up in. But to say this is all genetic is ridiculous. And that's something that everybody who does what I do for a living knows is true, because we change these behaviors every day of the week.
Right.
You know, and if it was truly only genetic and deterministic, we would change nothing. But now, genetic also has a different meaning. So we've got both the heritable behaviors, and then we've got things like epigenetic effects, which is how the expression of your genes is changed by stressors your mom experienced, which could be food or poor handling, stressors you experienced as a baby, stressors you experienced as a young adult. And those effects are not independent of either the environment or the genes you have. Some genes, some subsets of genes may buffer you more than others. So we now have a response surface that is much more complex than when I started this. And I think that, you know, they can put that on my tombstone. It was a lot more complex than she thought it was.
Love that. But I think, Karen, I think what you're talking about is it tracks very well with my own 30 years in breeding dogs, personal sort of, if you will, not scientific experiments, but experience that it is that complex. There are that many pieces that go into this, but it is also true that in a breed, there are families of dogs that exhibit X and families of dogs who do not exhibit X.
Absolutely. And defining X and then describing the phenotype of it and getting an accurate measure of that can be challenging in behavior. And this is one of the reasons some of the first big genetic studies were done on things like blindness and deafness. You would think things like blindness and deafness that pretty much everybody can recognize would be easy genetically. And that's how we ended up with all the different kinds of blindness we have, because
right.
They weren't.
Right.
You know, they just absolutely weren't. And of course, the treatments we have that can reverse blindness, those are revolutionary. Many of them developed at Penn over the past 20 years. And they're for the very rare forms. Why? Because those are the ones that are unique enough that you can track back to the defects.
Right, narrow it down.
And they'll be more simple. And, you know, what I'm looking at are a whole bunch of probably what are liability factors. And the risk factors, the genes associated with risk and liability, are further compounded by the way we breed dogs. One of our best noise-phobic pedigrees had a popular sire effect in it.
Mm-hmm.
The same guy showed up in every single generation.
Right.
And, you know, it just makes the story a nightmare, because how do I know that's not the same gene? It turned out not to be. I mean, that would have been, in one sense, boring but more simple. It was more complex than that, but it affects the way you have to look at it, and it really changes how much you think you actually know.
Right.
These are hard to do.
No, this is why this is fascinating to me. Okay, so next, we talked a little that nature versus nurture, it really is all of it combined. Are there, and if so, what are they? Are there tools for breeders that want to test or avoid, or is there anything you can say, pull DNA and look for this one thing and avoid it? I mean, anything like that?
No,
that's
would
what
be
I was afraid
really
of.
Good idea.
Just knew you were going to say that.
And let me tell you why. Well, but this is interesting, because I've spent the past 25 years developing a set of sort of semi-quantifiable assessment tools that are objective, so that we now know, for example, that there are 11 common behaviors that dogs can exhibit when they react to certain noises. So people can use those tools. They're in the public domain. people can use those same tools you would use for a history. You know, when someone comes to you and says, I can't get the dog off the ceiling on the 4th of July, you could use those tools if you had, say, border collies. Well over half the border collies probably in the U.S. are affected with some degree of distressing or pathological reactivity to noise. And let me just say why. I know a lot of people call this noise-sensitive dogs or noise sensitivity, and the reason we don't do that, I work with an audiology group, and sensitivity in audiology to them is the level at which you begin to respond to noise. So they think of it very differently. And that level in the population we measured didn't differ between the noise phobic and the non-noise phobic dogs, except for one dog who had hearing that was sufficiently sensitive that she could hear a whisper in the next building.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a little weird. But when we use those tools clinically, those tools should be able to be used to tell you when you begin to develop problems. So these behavior screens are underused and they're not tested. And I have to tell you, I have tried to convince the Norwegian Kennel Club, the American Kennel Club, and the Kennel Club of the UK that what we really need are a good set of early development and early assessment tools. And I don't just mean these questionnaires. They could be validated for that group of people following the dogs from puppyhood through their first 2 years of life. But we also need a simple set of assessments. You know, Scott and Fuller were way ahead of their time, and they looked at things like when your first tooth emerged, when you wagged your tail. And we did that. I provided a series of those screens for a group of mind detection dogs in Bosnia that some of my colleagues were working on. And what was shocking is how these highly selected Belgian Malinois in six litters had such close, they had so little variation in their neurodevelopment periods that produced both behaviors and anatomical and physical markers of development. But they were able to do it. And that is something that every breeder now with drop-down tools could do for the first 2 months of their dog's life. And within a year, we would have an excellent data set. And I'll bet anybody that breeds differ, and within breeds, dogs selected for different purposes differ. And it matters. And it matters because it matters how they develop and when you're going to do certain things with certain dogs and which dogs may need more and which dogs, it may not matter what you do. That dog's going to be a rock star with or without you.
Okay, so you're talking about things that are in the public domain. So you could email me some links so that some of our breeders can go and we can start taking a look at some of these things, right?
Yes, I can email you some.
Excellent.
And I will do that. And I'll even email you one of the screens so
yes,
that you can see
yes,
what they
anything
look like,
that you, you know? We have a website, okay, that is a blog post with the podcast. So people will have access to any material you want to share with us for our listeners. If you want input from breeders, if you have anything, tools, anything you have, please share it with us because absolutely we will post it up.
Great. And I'll share the tools with you from our most recent study because
yes,
we were even able to assess in old dogs, and this was very, very cool. We subjected a series of older dogs to cognitive testing every 4 months. And what turned out to be really cool was I thought that, oh, you know, we're going to watch these dogs and the 7 and 8 year olds. They're not going to fall off very much over a course of a year. But the 10, 11, 12, 13, 14-year-olds are going to decline dramatically in their performance.
Right.
Well, they slowed down physically a little bit, but they did not decline in their accuracy.
Interesting.
And the humans were really good at tracking the physical changes. They knew when they were beginning to see less well, but in terms of cognitive changes, they reported none. Now, what's remarkable about that is you have to think about who volunteers for a cognitive study.
Right.
You know, maybe these are the people who've been exercising their dog's brains all their lives, and by doing that, they've provided neuroprotection.
Right, so you're almost like self-limiting at a certain point.
You might be. But wouldn't it be interesting to see how people who aren't doing so much of that
right,
answer those questionnaires for those age groups? So those are the types of things that can be done. And they're just not being done.
Did I mention I'm completely geeked out by this?
Oh, good. I'm glad because I'm pretty geeky and I'm not really ashamed of it.
Okay, so here's one, and we're going to close with this just because this is part of why I'm so geeked out by it. I raised German wire hair pointers, okay?
Okay.
Along the way, early on in my breeding program, there was an introduction of a particular pedigree, and following the introduction of that pedigree, I started seeing what I so scientifically refer to as the Wakizuni gene, right? And, and it's just individuals, occasionally within litters, that are just reactive, right? Like, they're not as sound-minded, dead stable dogs. I'm not talking freak heads, but I'm just a little wacky.
And right, I see and to lots of things, nothing yeah, specific,
exactly.
Just stuff.
Each yep, one has something.
I see a lot just, of those dogs, yeah. Yep,
they're just not the sound-minded, solid, honest, dead-level, bomb-proof dogs that I'm accustomed to.
Right.
In the rest of my litters. And interestingly enough, and I have tracked this unscientifically, but nonetheless, from the introduction of that pedigree, and I want to test this with you, I'm curious as heck. From that pedigree, I bred down two animals from that litter, one male, one female. The male, I never have seen directly from him any of the Wakizuni gene pop up in any of the following generations. The female, it almost, I'm not going to say every litter, but consistently, I'll see somebody pop up with this, what I think of as the Wakizuni gene. And I remember it was actually Pat Lawrence who said this to me a million years ago, that in Dobermans, they had tracked that this questionable thing might follow on the sex hormones. And the sex chromosome, if you will, the X chromosome.
Yeah, that's what you've just described is suggests an X chromosome pattern.
Right, right. And that, to me, is that something that, has there been any actual legitimate real-life research other than in my own head?
Not a lot. But this is how it first starts. There have been X-linked diseases in dogs that show up this way. And sometimes it's a dosage effect. You know, you've got two X chromosomes, you should inactivate one of them. That doesn't always work out. You may have some effects. You know, we're finding out more about the Y chromosome all the time. But, you know, you may have to have had both to have had some effect at some point. So the big problem with looking at genetic contributions to patterns like you've just described is simply getting reliable numbers of dogs.
Right.
You know, when you can do a breeding program where you can breed the affected dogs to unaffected dogs,
mm-hmm.
then you can sort out genes with a small number of dogs. If what we're talking about are any types of genome scans or mapping, anything, any of the techniques that we use, the more dogs you have, the better. It becomes very hard to do just within a family, in part for the reason that I described, you know, where they've got overlapping family lines probably. If you breed them three times, well, you've still got mom or dad as that
and most
dog.
Of what you're breeding to is already sort of related and all of that kind of stuff.
There are ways to break those inbreeding loops, but it requires a lot, which is why when people bring dogs into the lab for genetic experiments, and when you look at things like the phosphofructose kinase genes and the retinal genes and some of the genes that have contributed to some of the really tragic neurological conditions like the ones Freddy Lingus and Norway works on, you know, those were identified by taking in the dog who had that and then breeding that dog to an unaffected dog and then looking at the phenotypes of the puppies and then breeding those to unaffected dogs so that you spread out the genes and now you can identify them. That's not what most people are doing in their household, and it's certainly not how we're going to treat human genetic conditions, which is why, you know, technology could potentially be our friend. Just remember, though, that when the first genes were published for human autism, they had 20,000 gene scans, 20,000 people in various families in those studies. And they only came up with one genetic region that they thought could be of risk, and it's gone not very far since then. This is hard.
Yeah.
You know, and we are looking for these causal factors, which may, in fact, if Eric Wilson's right, you know, 30% to the global phenotype of what makes one of his good working dogs, well, that means that many of these genes are influenced to some extent by the environment, where their expression is, where the combination is, and we're going to be playing the odds a lot. The best advice, despite the genetics work that we have, the best advice I give people is to go to the pedigree. And this is where paying attention to the behavior, phenotyping the behavior, doing some provocative tests can really help people. And I'll send you some information about that.
Absolutely.
But do that. to the extant dogs in the pedigree. Start keeping these records. You know, when people say to me, he suffers terribly with noise phobias, I don't know whether to breed him, here's his pedigree, and only 20% of the dogs don't suffer from noise phobia. Well, I think you can be pretty sure that this dog probably will, and he'll probably pass it on. Now, if the dog is perfect in all other regards, is that a problem? Well, now we're not talking about the same thing. Now we're talking about ethics and disclosure, because the vast majority of noise phobias, for example, we can treat. And if you're willing to treat aggressively, early, and often and maintain that, the dog can have a great quality of life. He'll still pass on that gene. That's what the entire CRISPR technology is about. And, you know, could we edit out that one section? Well, I anticipate in the next 10 or 15 years, we will be able to, whether we choose to do that.
Interesting.
I don't know what people will make as a choice. We're a little reluctant to muck around with some of those things.
Right.
But, you know, we're going to have to think of that. What I say to people is, if the dog is perfect in all of the respects, can you get homes that will meet these ethical and humane and welfare needs? And if you hesitate over that, you just answered your own question.
Right. Right. Okay, so now here's another question that I think is fascinating, and you touched on it a tiny little bit earlier on when you were talking about the border collies and some of the working dogs, because this sort of floats in the back of my mind. Are these dogs that are, in my example, Wakazuni genes, track also along with dogs who are particularly good at their jobs? So does this, right? These are working dogs. These are hunting bird dogs and good ones. And
this is the irony.
Yeah. Does that gene parallel, does the good working function, if you will, somehow tag along with this occasionally a little wacky?
You know, what you're really asking from the behavioral genetic standpoint is, does some aspect of what you inherit convey some type of advantage for your job?
Yes.
And this is what population geneticists would call balanced selection. So what they mean is that there's been selection for the job, and there's been some selection against the very extremes of the pathology, but not that mid-range that can possibly give you a good job. And there was a paper in PLOS One a few years ago from out of China that was looking at Belgian Malinois. They have a bunch of Belgian Malinois. And their Belgian Malinois, like everybody else's, tend to spin in circles when they're otherwise not engaged. And those are their working dogs. And I have never met a colony of working Belgian Malinois that don't do that.
Wow.
And they would be quite valuable, actually, because the spinning does cause some problems. Now, as a result, and you know, this is a chicken and an egg, did you get the spinning as a result of selecting for an extreme work phenotype that required conditions that you can't meet in the way you work or exercise those dogs? Or was it just there and it got enhanced because there was no cost to enhancing it? Well, we can't know the answer to that question. But the border collies we studied, we didn't see the noise reactivity or phobia to the extent in the benched border collies that we did in the working ones. And in fact, we worked with mostly working ones for that reason. And there's an old, I don't know whether it's a myth or something that people tell you, but a number of people told me that in the original Welsh lines of these working border collies, people thought that the ones who reacted to noise were faster and more attentive to the environment and better herding dogs. And if so, they've just done that. They've just selected for a pathology that's extreme as the result of getting what is probably marginal gain in performance here.
Right.
And those are the types of questions that fascinate me.
Me too. That's why I... Did I mention I was completely geeked out by this? Come on, man.
We don't have great ways to measure those things yet, and that's one of the things that I'd like to develop. And in fact, with a couple of my colleagues, I've been saying, well, what quick things could we measure just in a clinic office? You know, for example, if you look at my patient population, the anxious dogs, and I've talked to a number of people and everybody seems to see the same thing when they think about it. You know, I write down the time that the clients come in, and this is with behavior patients, so they're all there for a reason. And I don't expect any of them to be truly normal unless they have an attending dog, you know, a family dog that comes with them. But the dogs who are the most anxious cannot sit down for the first 20 minutes, and they may not sit down after that. We've had dogs that pace for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the least anxious dogs will sit after 20 minutes if there's not a lot of an uproar. So there's a way you can begin to divide things in groups. And should we have vets doing that? Of course we should. Should we have vets measuring whether or not dogs shy away if they reach for the dog? Of course. But that could just be because the vet scared them the last 40 times.
Right.
And there it is. So if we can get veterinarians and the veterinary staff to start engaging in procedures that diminish fear, we can then have them do some assays that could be meaningful behaviorally. They can do them now. They just don't know the extent to which they're at fault. So, for example, one of the things that I recommend veterinarians do is they come in, they sit in their exam room, and they wait for the dog to approach them. If that dog doesn't approach them in the first 5 or 10 minutes, that dog's afraid. You know, if they offer that dog a treat, can the dog take the treat? Can the dog take the treat only if it does so by grabbing, you know, hard? Or can the dog not take the treat? Well, a study by Bjorn Forkman in Denmark last year showed that dogs can take the treats in the waiting room, but they can't take them once they get to the exam room. And they take them with great enthusiasm and gusto when they're in the parking lot in a way that's very different than the way they take them in the waiting room. So that tells you that the dog views the stages of going to the vet very differently. It's a dog's eye view of what they're experiencing. The parking lot is not great. You know we're at the vet's, but this is okay. I'm outside. I get into the waiting room. Oh, God, I'm closer. And I get into the exam room. Can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating stuff. And, Karen, honestly, I could sit here and yak with you all day, but I know you have things to do. So
I do.
Truly appreciate your time and am very, very interested to see the information you send. And I've got a litter I'm planning, so hopefully there'll be things in there, some tools I can use and maybe have a different evaluation technique. I've been doing temperament evaluation for years, but I'm always looking for something new and different. So very excited.
Sounds good.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And it was great fun.
Okay, crew, we're all continually striving for expert level, right? But over at Royal Canin, expertly bred, expertly fed isn't just a tagline. These guys obsess over purebred dogs and the perfect nutrition for each one of them. Royal Canin formulas are developed with your breed's unique needs in mind for superior muscle tone, coat health, and digestion. As breed experts, we know the right nutrition can unlock the magnificence in our dogs. And the best part is, so do the Royal Canin folks. And they're showing their support for purebred dogs every day, including supporting your favorite podcast. So check out the Royal Canin Crown Partners Breeder Rewards Program. It's a major win for breeders. You can visit my.royalcanin.com to sign up. Membership benefits include 20% savings over in-store prices, quarterly rewards, free puppy kits, exclusive promotions, and a whole lot more. Check it out, crew. All right, crew, we are back with Allison Foley from the Leading Edge Dog Show Academy. And today we're going to talk about handling / grooming trick. And that is look at the dog on the table, but look at the dog on the ground. Right, Allison?
Exactly, Laura. So we were having this conversation recently at a dog show. And we talked about how many people never take their dog off a table or look at it off of a table, except for when they're in the actual ring. And I think that this is true for all kinds of dogs, but I am going to kind of really talk about dogs that are judged on the table. So many people with toy breeds and dachshunds and cockers and stuff, they obsess over every little hair and how their dog is perfectly stacked, etc., on the table, right? Like they're just, every little hair has to be perfect and it has to look great from that angle. And I get that. Like, you know, I obsess myself, but even a table breed, the judge looks at that dog in the ring 97% of the time on the floor.
Right.
So think of it. Even a table breed is judged 97% of the time on the floor. If we talk about things that I talk about in my Ultimate Guide to Handling Your Dog, which is, remember, the judge points at the end of the class, right? Like save something for the end of the class. Likewise, a judge points at your table dog on the floor.
Yep.
Rare instances is your dog pointed at on the table. And you and I talked about this ourselves. Big dogs, too, right? We obsess about their underline, their elbows, their feet, what everything looks like. But really, do your work on the table. It's easier for you. It's easier for the dog. I get that. But look at your dog at all the time. You know, if you're trimming your dog for an hour, every 20 minutes, that dog should be on the ground so you know what it looks like. So you know what your dog looks like on the ground from the judge's perspective. And like you and I talked about earlier, Laura, from far away, from the other side of the ring. Like often the judge isn't judging your dog 3 feet away from your dog. They're 10 or 12 or 15 feet away from your dog. So stand that far away. See what that top line, because, you know, dogs that have multiple colors on their top line, when you get further away, that can create an optical illusion. So you could be grooming a fault into your dog that your dog doesn't have.
I think too, Allison, mirrors. I'd love to talk about mirrors, how important those are to do exactly what you're talking about.
And I totally agree, Laura, but 100% of the grooming rooms that I have been in that have mirrors, where do they have them? They have them at table height.
Yes, they do.
Yes. So I have a mirror on my floor.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So yes, I love mirrors. I trim with mirrors. I think they're great. Every single kennel, every single grooming room that I've been in, the mirror is at table height.
Yeah. I loved the one that I had at one of the kennels that I trained at, and they had the whole training room. The mirrors were 3 feet from the floor, right? So they started at the floor and went up to 3 feet. Those were perfect to see your dog stack, see your dog's trim, you know? And I think that you are absolutely right. We completely lose that if we're not very consciously thinking about it.
Yeah. And I think that it is really important. You know, you have these really hairy dogs and we're working on their trim and, you know, their spray up like on a toy poodle or the top line on a Portuguese water dog, and we have it perfect on the table, but you move that dog to the ground and the total perspective of that dog changes, right? And especially those little dogs, look at what their head trim looks like when they actually look up at the judge, right? Like when the judge walks down the line for that last expression before they go to point at a class, what does your dog's expression look like when it's looking up at the judge? Do you have the hair so heavy that it's pulling the eyes back? You know, you have to think of all these things. And I know that it's really helped me to really look at my dogs on the floor.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Allison. Listeners, don't forget, Pure Dog Talk 25 is your checkout code when you go to sign up for one of Allison's Leading Edge Dog Show Academy courses. And that will give you a 25% discount on your class. And have a cup of coffee on us, yeah?
Yeah. And, you know, I love my Pure Dog Talk students. And, you know, we have an interactive Facebook group for all of our Ultimate Guide or Poodle University students. And I just love the interaction from my Pure Dog Talk peeps. So keep signing up, people. We love having you.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Allison.
Thanks, Laura.
The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk, brought to you by the Aramedia Group, publisher of ShowSite Magazine, your home for purebred dogs.